to call to order today's hearing on, in the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, today, March 5, 2004. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland. Anderson.
Here.
Blaine.
Yep.
Ellison. Fuller. Hillstrom.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson. Lesh. Lippman.
Here.
Meslow. Murphy.
Here.
Hamer.
Here.
Hall.
Here.
Rhodes. Soderstrom.
Here.
Strand. Tao.
Here.
Walls.
Here.
Okay, the chair notes that we do have presence of a quorum. Thank you for coming today wonderful March wintry day. I apologize for being late. Some of us have committee hearings going on in other rooms, and we have to at least check in and see what's going on and try to get back and forth. So I promise that I won't report to anyone's presence here on a Friday. Representative Murphy, you included. And with that, let's proceed with item one on the agenda, which will be House File 1817, Representative Coles, dealing with service animals, restitution required for harm done by dogs to service animals. Representative Coles. The chair will move your bill to get it before the committee. Do you have a routing on this bill? Where does it go from here?
It goes to General Register.
All right, then I'll. The motion will be that it be recommended passed.
Mr. Chair, there is a DE1 amendment that would put the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss it. If you'd be willing to move that, I'd appreciate it.
Chair, I'll move the DE1 amendment. Get the bill in the shape the author wants. Is there any discussion on the amendment? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended, so go ahead, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1817 is a relatively straightforward bill that creates a misdemeanor offense for individuals who fail to maintain control of their dog, and that dog then attacks and injures a service animal. The bill provides for restitution to the owner of the service animal for the costs and expenses associated with the attack. When I was first approached about carrying this legislation, I was unaware of why such legislation would be necessary. I've since come to learn a great deal about the issue and about the service animals and their handlers who would be affected by the bill. First, service animals are highly trained animals that serve to enhance a disabled person's freedom, safety, and independence. To fully train the dog and the handler can cost tens of thousands of dollars. When a service animal is attacked and injured, an individual with a disability can have their independence and mobility suddenly and severely restricted. One of the problems, of course, is that an individual with a disability may not be able to recognize an impending attack before it occurs and may not be able to do much to help the attack after, to help stop the attack after it has begun. Attacks can be costly in terms of veterinary care, retraining, replacement of the animal, costs similar to that. There are 27 states, including the state of Minnesota, that have laws providing various protections to owners of service animals. Current Minnesota law provides criminal sanctions against individuals who injure or kill service animals, but there's nothing that addresses the issue of service animals being injured by other dogs. Members, this bill is supported by a number of organizations, including Minnesota Guide Dog Users, the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota, the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, Hearing and Service Dogs of Minnesota, an organization called Helping Paws, Minnesota Council on Disability, Second Chance Animal Shelter, and an organization called Retrieve a Golden of Minnesota. I have with me today Mr. Phil Kragness, the president of Minnesota Guide Dog Users, to provide some brief testimony, and then we'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Kragness, we are maintaining audio records. I'd ask you to introduce yourself and then proceed. Would you also introduce your companion?
Good morning. My name is Phil Kragness, and as Representative Cole says, I am the president of Minnesota Guide Dog Users. It's a consumer organization and part of a national and international organization called Guide Dog Users Incorporated. And today, unfortunately with the bad weather, I'm only joined by my seeing eye dog, Juanetta.
Thank you. Would you care to tell us why we should move this bill?
Well, when our organization began listening to members and other dog guide users, service animal users, hearing dog users, we kept hearing about the problem of interference by other animals, and particularly the horror stories of attacks on those animals, some resulting in physical damage to either the dog and or the handler, some cases psychological trauma to the animal so that it was no longer able to perform its work, either scared to do its work or became aggressive and had to be retired. The cost to individuals can be enormous. As Representative Coles alluded to, there's not only, in some cases, replacement of the animal, but also veterinary bills, finances, lost wages from time off from work for caring for an animal or having to work for replacement. And so we felt that in those cases of attack, we, since the negligence or in some cases intent of other individuals should not result in financial hardship on the handler. At the same time, we realize accidents happen. Friends, families, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, you know, go out to get the morning paper, the dog slips out and traumatizes a service animal. When we thought about those types of accidents, we realized that our goal was not to bring harsh punitive measures in terms of incarceration or jail time. We simply wanted to be compensated for those financial hardships that we would endure. And that's how this bill came about.
Very good, Mr. Cragness. Any questions of this witness from the committee? Representative Towell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cole, I'm a co-author of this bill as well. Originally, you didn't have the misdemeanor charge on it with the new amendments that's in there. Just a clarification for that, please.
Sure. Representative Coles, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, when this bill was originally heard over in, in its first committee in the Senate, an issue was identified with that. The fact that there was no misdemeanor offense made the made restitution not possible. So we had to create at least a misdemeanor offense so that the restitution, the goal of this legislation, could be accomplished.
Representative Tal, anything else?
Why should it matter? They caused the reaction in the victim.
Any other questions? Anyone in the room wanting to be heard on this bill? Raise your hand.
I have one question.
I see no further testimony, Representative Eastland.
I just have a question, and it's because I'm probably ignorant a little bit of the the role of service animals. Totally, are service animals ever inclined to be protective?
Mr. Cragness.
And how does that play into a role if there's, I mean, if you have to be walking on the sidewalk past and there's a kind of a confrontational issue that happens between animals. Sometimes that isn't necessarily provoked. I mean, it's mutually provoked, put it that way.
Mr. Cragness.
Most service animals are bred and trained to be docile. Their job is to either lead or pick up objects, assist the person, the handler with the disability. If there is aggression, as I said, when an attack does occur, if the animal becomes aggressive as a result of that attack, that would be grounds to retire the animal from service. Because we are working in the public with our service animals, regardless of what type, whether it's a guide, a service animal, or a hearing dog, we can't risk any aggressive behavior towards people or other animals. So the likelihood of the dog inciting an attack is very, very minimal. In most cases, the dog is probably going to take a more submissive posture or try to flee the scene. And of course, the issue then becomes, well, if it's a person with a physical impairment who requires that dog to pull their wheelchair and the dog is trying to get away, then that person is in severe jeopardy. Likewise, at least the school that I obtained my dog from, we're trained to release our dog's harness and leash in order to give the dog the optimal chance of surviving the attack. And in that case, as a blind person, I'm left stranded in those cases. So the response for most service animals is probably going to be flight. Under the Americans with Disabilities and the Code of Federal Regulations 36.104, The definition currently does include dogs trained for protection, but most service animal owners, that is guide, hearing, and dog guide, are working very hard to try to get that language changed, as we don't see protection as a viable service animal.
Any additional questions from anyone? Seeing none, then, Mr. Ragnos, thank you, and Winnetka, for coming today to support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coles, for bringing it forward. Chair will renew his motion that House File 1817, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Next item will be House File 2163, Representative Knobloch, Trespass Law Expanded. Chair will move House File 2163, get it before the committee. Where does this bill get routed to?
To the General Register, Mr. Chair.
You sure it doesn't need to go to some other committee? What, ways and...
I don't think there's a...
All right.
I don't think there's a... fiscal note on it.
Okay, the motion stands and be recommended to pass. Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
All right. Mr. Chairman, first of all, if I could, I've got an amendment to the bill, the A2 amendment that if I could, I'd like moved. And
Chair will move the House File, the amendment H2163A2 to get the bill in the shape the author requests. No discussion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended.
Mr. Chairman, members, basically what House File 2163 as amended does is it changes the trespass law so that currently if an owner of a store, for example, tells someone to leave the property, they have to be gone for 30 days. This would move that standard up to 1 year and make it the same for schools as well when someone is instructed to leave a school. There have been problems with people who are told to leave, maybe a shoplifter or something like that, coming back right at that 30-day period, and it's caused a nuisance problem for a number of people. And to elaborate on that, I've got a couple of witnesses. For starters, I have Matt Larson with the Coburn Stores up in the St. Cloud area, and I also have Rob Allen with the Minneapolis Police Department. And if I could, I'd like to have Mr. Larson testify first.
Mr. Larson, give us your name and then proceed.
My name is Matthew Thomas Larson. Excuse me, I'm Director of Loss Prevention for Coburn's Incorporated. And I deal with basically anything that creates a loss to the company. One of the primary areas that we deal with are external theft. And in our loss prevention shoplifter apprehension program, we have a real problem in some communities because we're only able to keep people out of our stores for 30 days. And the cost justification of catching the shoplifters can't be met on a one-to-one basis where you stop them, you recover $20 worth of merchandise, and you've expended $80-$100 in labor to do that. So the only way to really cost justify shoplifter apprehension is once you identify the individuals that are causing you the losses as a business owner is to keep them out of your premises. And basically, the 30-day makes it difficult to cost justify. We do end up dealing with a lot of people. It is a fairly significant problem. And we've dealt with some people literally 18, 20 times, the same individuals. They know the 30-day rule. They wait for 30 days. They come back to our stores. We catch them stealing another $80 worth of stuff. It tends to be just kind of a revolving door. We just catch the same guys again and again, and there's a number. We're not that big of a retailer, but we still have identified a number of people that are doing that to us. We also do deal with some safety issues where people have made threats or some other items. People have just had some problems, fights, whatever, within our stores, and we just want that flexibility to look at each individual case and say how long we want that person to be not allowed back in.
Any questions from the committee of this witness? Thank Thank you. Do you have someone else?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Rob Allen.
Excuse me. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, sir, how often does a person that is not on their first shop with the experience come back again and again and again?
Mr. Larson.
I don't have any statistics that show exactly, but we do run into it quite frequently. But as far as a percentage, I'm not sure.
Very good. If there's no other questions, thank you, Mr. Larson. Your next witness. Morning, sir. Give us your name and then go ahead.
I'm Inspector Rob Allen from the Minneapolis Police Department. I come in the first precinct for the Minneapolis Police Department, which is downtown Minneapolis. And one of the issues that has been addressed by the community that we serve is that we have the same people committing crimes over and over again. And one of the challenges that we put to the businesses is to proactively address crimes, make an environment where it's unsafe to commit crimes, and where people will choose, if they're going to do crimes, to do them elsewhere. One of the pieces of feedback that we hear on a regular basis is that's very hard to do with a trespass ordinance that keeps people out for 30 days. If people get arrested, the cases very often aren't adjudicated within that 30-day period. So one of the tactics that we've been adopting recently is to get geographical restrictions placed on people as terms of their probation when they are sentenced. And that they're they're not allowed to be in the downtown area. But businesses don't have that option frequently, and that adjudication doesn't happen within the time period that the trespass warning has been issued. We're very much in support of this bill to give property owners the ability to prevent or reduce the incidence of livability crimes such as disorderly conduct, public urination, and loitering with the intent to buy or sell narcotics on their property. Property owners who encounter intoxicated persons on their property know that these individuals have a greater likelihood of committing the aforementioned livability crimes. Empowering property owners with the ability to issue an effective trespass order likely increases the public's utilization of such orders and reduces livability crimes. It also creates an opportunity for the community to work jointly with the police officers and prosecutors to address public safety. In an era where we have few police officers, we're outnumbered 25 to 1 by private security in downtown Minneapolis. And this gives them an important resource to take that proactive crime reduction stance. Many businesses do not utilize the trespass statute because the realistic belief, frankly, that it's too short in length to have an effective impact. And it also provides a deterrent, an effective deterrent, to keep people away who are committing crimes and on businesses. People are very aware of when their 30 days are up, and I can't stress that enough. The people who get the trespass warnings typically stay away during that 30-day period, but they're back at day 31. And I think this bill does a nice job of changing the law so that a business can allow somebody keep somebody out of the business for a one-year period without telling them 12 different times that they have to stay out of the business for that one-year period.
Any questions of Inspector Allen? Representative Paymer.
I'm just curious about how current law works, actually, with this. I was reading this earlier, and let's say I'm a business owner and someone comes in that I don't particularly want in my business, and then I tell that person to leave. They leave. How do you ensure that you're identifying the same person who's then come back? And then how would someone get charged if the person said, "Well, I wasn't in your store"? I mean, how do you?
To make an arrest, the same thing has to be exist. A probable cause has to exist that a person has committed a crime, and in order to have that probable cause, we need to see a record of the trespass warning that's issued, and virtually every business in my precinct takes a photograph at the time that they issue the trespass warning, staples it to the trespass warning, and dates it. So the officer responding comes and looks and sees that a valid trespass warning was issued on the date that it was issued with a photograph of the same offender that's in front of you.
So, Mr. Chair, so that's a requirement then that the business owner would have a photograph in order to clearly identify the individual?
That's the training we do with business owners in order to show just with any citizen's arrest that there's a the probable cause exists that a crime has been committed so that we can make an arrest for trespassing.
Mr. Chair, if you didn't have the photograph, would you have probable cause? Could you have?
There are other alternatives. If the person was ID'd by a state, you know, the ID and the driver's license number was on the trespass warning, for example, and, you know, that's indeed the same person that's in front of us now, that's another way that they do it. But typically our city attorneys who prosecute the cases have asked us to train the businesses to take a photograph because it's most effective at that time.
Mr. Chair, final question. I mean, is there any, do you worry at all that our current trespass law or this expansion of the trespass law could be used for discriminatory practices by business owners?
Representative, one of the pieces of training that we do in our police department is to make sure that, and actually resulted from a lawsuit a few years ago, one of the pieces of training we do with our police officers is to ensure that the reason that any kind of enforcement action is being taken is based on legitimate legal grounds and not based on some discriminatory action, and that there is, in fact, grounds for the person to be trespassed from our building.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Inspector Allen. Did anyone else? No?
No.
Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand. I see no other testimony. Is there further discussion? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nabok, do you have any evidence for the problems in smaller towns in upstate Minnesota that would the retailers, do they have similar circumstances?
Representative, no.
Over and over.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I guess I'm not sure what your definition of a smaller town is. The Representative Matt Larson, who is here from Coburn's, is headquartered in St. Cloud. So he's spoken of their problems at Coburn's. Coburn's has a number of stores around rural Minnesota. I don't know about really, really small towns, but I believe this is a problem in other towns just besides the city of St. Cloud, some of which are smaller. I could have him come back up if he wanted to talk about specific cities.
No,
Representative Murphy.
No, Mr. Chair, Cochran is probably smaller than St. Cloud. Or in the town where there's like one store, or one grocery store, or one mercantile, and a person goes in and seizes an object, and then that person can't go back for a year. Maybe that person won't go over and over and over. Maybe the one chance deal would be better for that person rather than saying no for 12 months when we don't know that that person is a repeater.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Chairman Smith, Representative Murphy, I guess I'd say maybe they shouldn't have stole the object in the first place.
Maybe they shouldn't have, but maybe people deserve a second chance in some cases. And this bill doesn't allow that second chance, as I see it. Maybe Mr. Debo's can tell me. It's definitely a year in every circumstance, isn't it? And the judge can't look at the person and say, they promised me that you'll never go into that, or you'll never do that again if we let you go back after 30 days.
To that point, Representative Eastland, do you have something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. I'm a co-author on the bill, and this is what I was concerned about this before I signed on to the bill, and I guess where I found my comfort in this issue was that basically, like in a small town situation, if the consent of the property owner is given, then the one-year time period is waived. So I mean, there is some room in here for a person, if it's a first-time offender and if it was in a situation where somebody just got caught in the situation, and the property owner could give the consent to have that 1 year waived and they could come back.
In every circumstance? I mean, for a first-time deal?
Well, actually, for any offender, that could be the case. And I guess that's where I saw it. Item, it's page 3-8, I think. It's talking about...
let's make this a three-way conference. Mr. Diebold, did you have something to add?
He maybe is more clear on it than I do, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I think Representative Eastland has it correct that under Provision 8 on page 3, that the owner or person with authority can allow people to come back onto the property. So, and this would take a voluntary action on the owner or the person with authority to enforce the order. So that would, perhaps the consent would be implicit by not enforcing the order.
Representative Murphy, further on that, if you do. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any, I support the property owner's ability to keep somebody off their property for a year if need be, but I do have questions about the school portion of this on page 4. We're crossing out within 6 months and adding at any time after being told by the school principal or the principal's designee. First of all, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, can you define who the principal's designee would be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell, I guess it would be whoever the principal designated. I mean, an assistant principal or someone else who was in charge of the school.
And I don't know if I could maybe have Ms. Parda come up here. I think we had someone from the schools that was maybe going to come and testify in favor of this bill as well. Mr. Chairman, if I could maybe have Ms. Parda speak to that.
State your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Abby Parda, and I'm the Government Affairs Manager for the Minnesota Grocers Association. And one thing I also want to point out, Representative Paul, is the amendment would also limit to 1 year, not at any time, for the trespass for schools.
What is that at?
It doesn't say that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it says that. I'm willing to be corrected.
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe I could have an oral amendment on page 4, line 4, to change the at any time to within 1 year.
All right. At this time, the chair will entertain the chair's motion to orally alter the bill as just stated. Is there any question on that amendment? Is there any discussion on that amendment? All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. That oral amendment is adopted. Now we're back on the bill as adopted. Representative Powell, does that take care of your concerns?
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you.
All right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about schools. What about kids who are skipping class and get cited for trespassing because they're on the property but they are not where they're supposed to be?
Representative Knobloch.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question, Representative Hillstrom?
Sure. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
What about kids who are skipping class, but they're on the property, hanging out, and they're cited for trespass? In fact, maybe we want them to come back to school?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I mean, I guess this is, as I understand it, a decision, again, of the principal. And, I mean, if the principal wants them back, and presumably he does underneath the circumstance you're talking about, they would be able to come back with his permission. I think this is more for other people who are not students, maybe people who are feared to be stalking a student or harassing a student or something like that that this would apply to.
Anything further? Representative Murphy again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask Mr. Colburn or Mr. Larson about from Colburn's on page 3, line 4 through 7. Can you see yourself using that provision?
The 1 year rule?
The part where they don't have to stay off, where you could impose it so they don't have to stay off for a year.
Well, we do that all the time. Even with our 30-day, we make exceptions on that. When we find out there are special issues with individuals, certain needs that only we can take care of, and we do operate in a lot of very small towns, Lawn Prairie, some those types of locations, and in those areas in particular, where we see the majority of the problems are where it's a little bit more urban, like St. Cloud, where we have multiple locations in a small area because the same people are hitting all these stores. They're jumping from location to location. In those smaller towns, we don't see as much of a problem, and shoplifting tends to get dealt with somewhat differently in those towns. Very small communities, everyone knows what's going on in the community. If we were to ban Mrs. Smith from our store for stealing a donut, we wouldn't have very many customers. Not just because Mrs. Smith wouldn't be coming back, but because the majority of that town wouldn't be coming back. So it's kind of a self-correcting issue. And frankly, the problem isn't that great in rural Minnesota, but it certainly doesn't do any harm.
And so you do take it on a case-by-case basis?
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Larson, after this hearing, you can explain to me why a Mrs. Smith would be stealing one of your donuts.
Sounds good.
Any further questions on the bill? All right, then, the House File 2163, as amended, is before us and will be recommended to pass. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right. House File 1957, Representative De La Forest, interfering with ambulance service personnel who are providing emergency care established as a crime. Representative De La Forest.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Cicero moved the bill to get it before the committee. One second. I believe what we'll do is the motion will be to be recommended to pass, but I think when we're done, we're going to lay it over because we have a fiscal note on it. We'll lay it over for consideration. That's understandable.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. Bill is before us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. I'm Representative Chris De La Forest. I represent District 49A. The bill you have before you this morning, House File 1957, is a straightforward bill and corrects what I believe is an anomaly in our criminal code and certainly a gap in Minnesota's public policy with respect to ambulance service personnel. As you can see from the bill, and as many of you know, we do have provisions in our criminal code which make it a crime to interfere with police officers and firefighters in the execution of their duties. As of now, we do not have the same protections afforded to our paramedics. I think that the protections afforded to firefighters and police officers are good public policy. I think that the same protection should be afforded as well to our ambulance service personnel. The inspiration for this bill is a gentleman sitting next to me today. His name is Rob Snyder. He lives in Andover, my hometown, and he is a paramedic with HCMC and brought this issue to my attention and to Mr. O.J. Doyle's attention as well. As many of you know, he represents the Ambulance Association. He was scheduled to testify today, Mr. Chairman and members, but apparently not the roads, but the flu has laid him low. But he certainly supports this bill as well. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Snyder to provide some brief testimony, and then we'd certainly be happy to stand for questions.
Very good. Mr. Snyder, go ahead, give us your name, and proceed.
My name is Robert Snyder. I'm a resident of Andover, as Mr. De La Forest stated. I give Mr. De La Forest stated my concerns quite well. In the summer of 2003, I was disappointed in a response I got from the city attorney in Minneapolis. During July, I was responded to an emergency call where an intoxicated female had fallen off her bike, struck her head. At that time, my partner and I proceeded to provide care to the patient. moved her to the ambulance, and where we encountered an unknown individual to us who entered our ambulance, attempted to remove the victim from our ambulance. At that time, we initiated a call for emergency help from the police, and I kept the unknown party at bay. It turned out that this party was a fellow drinking partner of hers, and felt that she would be best served going home with him to go to sleep. As I kept the suspect at bay and awaited the help of the Minneapolis Police Department, the victim became very uncooperative, and the suspect at that time went to solicit help from his other friends and to remove her from the ambulance. To our good fortune, the Minneapolis police arrived on scene. The suspect attempted to flee and was apprehended and charged. When I spoke to the city attorney, he basically broke it down and said, if you're a firefighter, we could pursue this a different way. If you're a police officer, we could pursue it a different way. Since there is no legal recognition of interfering with emergency medical service personnel, his charge will be disorderly conduct. Although he put the lives of the victim at stake, he put our lives at stake and created a very unruly environment for us. So with that, I contacted my local legislator, and I'm here before you today.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness?
Just briefly.
Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eva Forrest, it's not your intention to have this 1957, if it were enacted, to limit in any way the injured person's right to refuse care from a paramedic or an ambulance personnel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, you're correct.
Okay.
Great. Further questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, how do you anticipate handling this if police were unable to arrive? Do emergency medical personnel anticipate carrying a tag book, or do you just plan to identify them in the same way you pursue any other investigation?
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, currently we do not carry a tag book of any of that. Basically, now I can tell someone who's interfering, you're breaking the law, obstructing or interfering with the treatment or transport of someone. If this bill passes, I could speak to them and tell them that. Currently, paramedics have to wait to be assaulted or other things happen to us before we can file charges against these people. This bill, to me, sir, it protects the patient and the paramedics.
Representative West.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, why was it that the disorderly conduct charge was unsatisfactory resolution for you in this case?
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I felt that due to the circumstances, the patient's life was put at stake, our lives were put at stake. We created a tremendous situation in a neighborhood where a bunch of residents who were at a local bar became unruly, and we delayed the treatment and transportation of this patient. That's why this bill is so important to me, is that the disorderly conduct is really doesn't suffice for what the actions of this person did.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, if I may as well, Representative Lesh, as you know, I know you're a prosecutor, that as well, the disorderly conduct charge, as you know, subsequently, when you look at a criminal record, can mean a variety of things these days. We know that some vicious physical assaults can be pled down to a disorderly conduct, or you can be plead to a conviction on disorderly conduct for having your stereo too loud in your apartment. And one of the things that that I think helps prosecutors, and I have just a tiny bit of experience doing that, is when someone is before you and you look at priors, a disorderly conduct may not be very indicative of the kind of person you're dealing with, whereas if you can see a prior conviction for interfering with a police officer or ambulance service personnel, may help you administer justice in a more equitable way.
Representative Eastland, then Powell. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either Representative DeForest or either can you answer this, but how would if this law had been in effect, how would that have changed anything that occurred that day?
Mr. Snyder.
That's my first question. My second question is, how often is there a situation that would come under the purview of this law that you have right here? I mean, how often do these kind of disturbances occur?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, I don't know if this would deter the actions of this intoxicated individual that entered our ambulance. This is more of a prosecutorial type of event that would give greater satisfaction to the people, the men and women who put their lives on the line out there. However, the data that you may be looking for, I have no data locally. I only was able to research national data. And that basically said that there was a violent event at 8% of all of our emergency encounters. Of those 8%, 4%, roughly 4%, was verbal, directed towards us. And the other 4% was verbal and physical, directed towards EMS personnel. And that came from the Loma Linda University June to April 2002 study.
And follow up?
Representative Eastland.
That kind of leads into the other question I have. So I guess in the terms of this language here, anything that obstructs, resists, interferes with a peace officer, so what does that include verbal? Does that include a frustrated relative or person who wants to, who would rather that the person was not being taken? I guess it seems like we have a lot of gray area in this that's going to be hard to determine what an obstruction really is. And I guess these are, it's intense times, and there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of passion, there's a lot of things going on, and certainly I understand and I really agree and respect the need for the emergency service personnel to feel protected and feel like they have the right to do their job, but I guess from the other side I'm just trying to understand what this means to the people that are in the periphery when all this is occurring, and how often do you think this would be actually used? This is kind of where I'm getting going,
Mr. Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland. If Mr. Doyle were here today, he would tell you that right now there are some paramedical organizations in the Twin Cities where the paramedics wear flak vests on duty because of some of the violence they have experienced in their job. The other point I'd like to make with respect to this is, you're right, there are some gray areas, and it's certainly an area, if this were to become law, where there would be some discretion in the criminal justice branch. The prosecutors, courts would have some discretion to decide, and I'm comfortable with that. And more so, I think what's important is that right now, you know, looking at the posture of this bill, so to speak, we already have this protection for police and fire, but also for some paramedics. If you are a paramedic who's employed, say, by the St. Paul Fire Department, you also get this protection under the firefighter provision. So right now we've got a situation where we have some paramedics who are covered with this protection and some who are not. And as we all know, too sadly from events of the recent past, that paramedics, firefighters, peace officers, they all work together in some very dangerous and violent situations. And so I think the public policy, and the reason I support this bill and agreed to chief author it, is because I think the public policy of this state should speak to all these personnel and saying all of them deserve this protection, not just some.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would support the testimony by Mr. Snyder concerning the rate of violence on the job. I work with Rob as a paramedic, and I think the number of 8% is pretty good when it comes to confrontation, and that 4% of the time where there is actually violent or potential violent confrontation is pretty accurate. If you're doing 1,000 runs a year, which is, at our department, fairly average, that's 40 times a year, and that you are in where a violent situation happens. And what we're trying to do here with this bill is protect the patient so the patient gets the care that they need. It's not so much a protection of the paramedic. The other thing is that, again, the police are there to render emergency care as first responders. They have this protection. The firefighters are there to render first emergency care. They have the protection. It seems just to be an oversight not to give the protection to the people that are there to provide the definitive care for the patient.
Any further discussion on this bill or questions? Anyone else present wishing to testify on this bill? I see nobody. All right, then House File 1957 will be laid over for possible inclusion later on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you. Next item would be House File 2281, Representative Whitman, regarding victims of juvenile acts, provided information, victim definition clarified, release of city of residence of defendant to victim upon request, and Revenue Recapture Act time limit for filing a claim reduced. House File 2281, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I move that House File 2281 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
All right, that's the motion before us. Tell us about your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to at least put in the 1023 amendment with a slight modification where we're deleting two of the sections so that I could get the bill in the shape that I would most prefer.
All right.
I would move adoption of the 1023 amendment. I can certainly tell you about that less both sections 1 and 2, which I...
All right, let's see if we can treat the 1023 amendment as an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he chooses. Any discussion? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those say no. That does pass. Now the bill before us is amended.
Okay, just with respect to the amendment first, originally House File 2281 is the DPS, Department of Public Safety, agency bill on behalf of the Crime Victim Services Office. Because we were, in a sense, going to the dance, I was pleased and very proud to be able to help the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault add two related provisions, which is found in the 1023 amendment as amended. The 1023 amendment as amended broadens the categories of charges that would be eligible to have the filing fee waived for a harassment restraining order. Not only is this good public policy to extend beyond just stalking to include the various degrees of sexual misconduct, but it also is a policy that's necessary for Minnesota law to be in compliance with the Federal Violence Against Women's Act. So we need to have a broader set of waivers for harassment restraining orders in order for us to be compliant with federal law. And the remaining sections modify our stalking statute so as to include a particularly pernicious form of stalking, which is the stalkers using global positioning, satellite, and other monitoring equipment to remotely monitor their victim in ways that under the current law wouldn't come within the ambit of the stalking statute, because the victim who's not aware that they're being tracked and followed electronically don't have at that moment reaction on the part of, or fear on the part of the victim. And so it's a gap in our current law which hasn't kept up with technology so that we have a vigorous stalking set of statutes. I'm proud and pleased to put forward the 1023 amendment. And with us, we have an expert in this area for any committee questions, Karen Long, who is the staff attorney in the Sexual Violence Justice Unit of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Ms. Long, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. And I should clarify, I'm a former prosecutor. I have about 6 years of felony-level prosecution experience before coming to the Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I don't know if there are questions or if I should just address each section separately.
Well, let's first see if there are any questions from the committee. Why don't you walk us through the each article?
Well, as Representative Lippman indicated, currently the Violence Against Women Act, and I've passed out the language from that federal act, requires that states receiving VAWA funding must certify that the protective orders that are available to victims of both domestic violence and sexual assault are free. And currently, the fee in Minnesota is waived for victims of the stalking statute, but not for victims of sexual assault. And so we're asking that we incorporate that change in order to become compliant with the Violence Against Women Act. My understanding that from the Department of Justice in Minnesota is that approximately $2.291 million is contingent upon being compliant with that portion of the VAWA Act. And our understanding is that many counties do waive that fee for sex assault victims, but not all do. And some counties are insisting that they pay the approximately $245 fee in order to get a harassment restraining order against the individual who they allege sexually assaulted them. So we're asking that that be amended. Section 3 of this bill amends the statute on harassment restraining orders to allow a minor to apply for a harassment restraining order with the assistance of a step parent, as well as the previous language, which was a parent or guardian. And we are aware of situations where a parent or guardian is not available for some reason, they're out of town, or I believe even we know of a situation where somebody was serving in the military and a step parent tried to assist the minor child at home with applying for a harassment restraining order and was turned away because they're not a parent or guardian. So we just believe this allows minors a little better access with the involvement of the parents that they live with in their household. And I would point out that the order for protection statute is broader than that. It permits minors to obtain orders for protection in even more circumstances. So we believe this just brings up the level of availability for victims of sexual assault and other stalking harassment crimes to that of domestic violence. And then the harassment stalking modifications that we're putting forward are based on some information that we've received recently that in some areas of the country, and I can't tell you in Minnesota that there has been a specific case, there have been cases coming up in other parts of the country where stalkers will use a GPS locator and put it in the victim's car. Or there is spyware that you can surreptitiously download onto somebody else's computer that allows you to see what they're typing and what they're doing on their computer without your knowledge. And so, and I'm sure more technology than I'm even aware of. I don't pretend to know everything that's coming up. So what we're trying to do here is broaden the language that's currently in our stalking statute to account for those situations so that we can address them when they inevitably will begin to come up. And as Representative Lippman said, we are asking that the subdivision 1, parentheses 2, be removed for a couple of reasons, which is the requiring the prosecutor to prove that the victim actually has a reaction subjectively of feeling frightened, threatened, intimidated, or persecuted. And the reason we're asking for that to be removed is in these situations, the victim may not know for a period of time that they are being stalked or harassed or monitored and therefore are not going to have a subjective reaction. But I would point out, and I've come across this with talking with other prosecutors too, not just myself, that this section is unique in Minnesota law. We're not aware of other situations where we have to prove that a victim had a subjective reaction. That's pretty rare. And it's also unique, having looked at many other stalking statutes from other states, that is a unique provision. Other states are not requiring that the prosecutor prove a subjective reaction on the part of the victim. And so for those several reasons, we're asking that that be removed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'd be glad to entertain any questions on the 102-23 amendment. Otherwise, we can move along.
Representative Eastland, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a sensitive question, but I'd like to ask it. What do we have in statute, or how do we deal with the issue of false accusation and sexual harassment and sexual assault kinds of charges? I think we're bolstering the law for the victim here, and I think it's more and more common that we're finding situations where there is some false accusation. And what are the consequences for that kind of that we have in the law? Balance this issue a little bit.
Well, the consequence for a person that's falsely reporting any crime is that there is a misdemeanor crime of falsely reporting a crime. I'm not aware that there's any increased number of false accusations regarding sex assault. My understanding is that actually the statistics would say that sexual assaults are not falsely reported any more commonly than any other type of crime. And of course, you know, as we like to point out, if an individual comes in to report a sexual assault, they go through a 3 or 4 hour physical examination. They go through numerous hours of interviews by law enforcement. They then are subject to some pretty close questioning at trial. It's a difficult process to go through when you are genuinely reporting a crime, and so we don't find that to be a growing problem by any means. It's a rigorous process for a victim to go through. And so, as I said, there is a crime of falsely reporting a crime, and these statutes and the harassment restraining order language are subject to the same level of proof as any other statutes. A crime has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And really, as a prosecutor, I can tell you that sexual assaults many times are not charged, even when the prosecutor and law enforcement feel that it probably did occur, but they don't feel they have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's a difficult crime to pursue, which is why our organization is taking part.
Representative Eastland.
I understand that's why the question is a sensitive question, but I mean, I've also served on school boards and other places where we've had large employee pools, and we found that there is a significant number of false accusations and sexual harassment in the workplace. And I guess, given the severity of the consequences of that kind of an accusation being made public, it would seem appropriate that there would seem to be some balance in the law to reflect that. I mean, because that's a pretty serious accusation to have leveled against somebody if it's not founded and found to be untrue. 6 months later, the damage has been done to the person. And I think I understand and I respect the issue of sexual assault and understand how significant it is in our culture. And we need more teeth in that law. There's no question about that. But I'm just trying to figure out, is there a way we can proceed with some balance also?
Well, and I think sexual harassment in the workplace may sometimes produce a situation where a restraining order is issued, possibly, but really is a separate entity from the criminal sexual conduct that we're talking about in these bills. So I suspect that particular issue, if there are false allegations are going on, it's not really probably addressed by these particular provisions, would be my impression.
Any other questions? Representative Lipman.
Like I said, I do have two witnesses on the other line, Bill, if I might, very briefly.
Well,
just as to the amendment.
Let's go to that. Let me also raise this problem that I think what we're having here, two things. Mm-hmm. In two areas of your amendment, the bill has a fiscal impact. An agency bill should not have a fiscal impact. So we're going to either have to address these two items now and remove them from the amending action that we just took, or if the committee does not want to take the language out, then we're going to have to lay the bill over for fiscal note, which delays the bill.
Is it as to the waiver?
Well, it's the fee waiver, is number one. That creates a negative impact on waiving fees. Number two, if we're adding a language including monitors and other technological means to what is currently a listing of other actions that constitute a gross misdemeanor, that will also have a positive or a plus fiscal impact. So we've got those two things that we just did in your amendment. We can proceed to the testimony, but it strikes me that we, meaning the committee, by vote, is either going to have to remove that language, and if it doesn't want to, then we're going to have to lay the bill over for a fiscal note.
I guess it would be my preference to allow DPS, because they were eager to be helpful to MnCASA, assuming that it had just a policy impact. I'll introduce this as a separate bill today. or actually on Monday, and perhaps we could proceed that way.
So it would it then be your desire to reconsider the...
Yeah, I guess I would move to reconsider so that I don't keep the agency laid over for an indefinite time period. But, okay. But we'll reintroduce this and seek leave of the committee to represent these very same ideas in a better forum.
Well, since the committee did support adding this amendment, I guess if you choose to go the route of brand new bill with this, give it a hearing. So with that understanding,
yes.
I think the chair would move that we reconsider the action whereby we amended AO4-1023 to your bill. And for purposes of removing, to reconsider on that issue, any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Then we've got... I believe we now have to reconsider the amendment. So the amendment is before us, and under the discussion we've just had, it'd be my intent to vote no on the amendment and allow you to take it and reintroduce it and bring it back.
Yes.
So the AO4-1023 amendment is now before back before the committee. Discussion, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, did I represent amendment? During the discussion, during Ms. Long's testimony, did she say that it was with the new category then that would earn, and with waiving that fee, it would be $2.5 million? Is that what I heard?
I think any fiscal impact, either pro or negative, would oblige a different treatment as opposed to a pure policy bill. I'm clearly supportive of accomplishing the objectives of the 1023 amendment, and I plan to, get green jackets as soon as I can get out of this room to put it into the hopper and to return in the present week. The question I think we're presented today is whether the Department of Public Safety, with its agency pure policy bill, should be held over for possible inclusion as opposed to being reported to the floor.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lippman, I'd like to suggest that with the amendment, there's a lot better chance of us giving it more serious consideration. And the agency would be helping the cause a little bit if they kept their part in the bill in the amendment, with the amendment. I mean, this is serious stuff, and it deserves
yes.
it, and it deserves every consideration that we can make. And I think that we should just keep the amendment on and hold it over and have the discussion when we're talking about the omnibus bill. And the agency's requests, the things that the housekeeping that the agency wants would strengthen it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I will probably collect and snip the tape so that I can get a hearing next week on the very fine provisions of the 1023 amendment, because I agree with you that it is important policy. It needs to be done. But my original pledge to the Department of Public Safety, if they would give us a ride to the dance, is that they wouldn't be prejudiced, and they were pleased to do that because they likewise agree with the 1023 amendment. And I think so that I might keep my pledge, and we can keep policy just policy and fiscal matters just fiscal matters, that it's better to do it this way.
But then we're just going to be wallflowers at the dance. We're just going to the dance.
You would be the first on my dance card.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lippman, I think for purposes of expediting what we're doing, why don't you withdraw your amendment?
I will withdraw my amendment.
House File 2281, you have further testimony?
I do. House File 2281 is the Department of Public Safety Agency Bill with respect to the Crime Victim Services Office. It has three very simple propositions to improve the functioning of our criminal justice system for the victims of crime. The first is that when minor children are the victims of crime, that we would permit the parents to attend hearings and to make statements on behalf of their minor children that are victims. A very simple and ordinary common sense proposition which should already be a part of our law. Secondly, it improves access to information by crime victims by repealing the requirement that a formal request be made, and in non-restitution cases, that the victim, for their peace of mind, be able to learn about the city of residence of the offender who offended against them, who may well now be on probation. Lastly, it shortens the timeline for the spouses of offenders to submit claims for tax refunds from 18 months down to 3 months, so that these sums are more readily available for restitution. And with us as witnesses, we have from the Department of Public Safety, their general counsel, Lori Beyer-Kopetsky, and also from Washington County, the very best victim witness service coordinator in the state of Minnesota, Mary Waldkirk. And that's a few remarks from them.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I don't know if you have questions.
State your name and then go right ahead.
I'm Lori Beyer-Kopetsky. I'm with the Department of Public Safety. I'm their general counsel.
Thank you. And your name, ma'am?
I'm Mary Waldkirk. I'm with the Washington County Attorney's Office, and I'm the coordinator of the Victim Witness Program.
So do we have testimony, or are we just prepared?
They're available questions to answer questions. We're mindful of your time.
Questions? Committee?
If not, Mr. Chairman, I'd renew my motion that House File 2281 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register.
That's the motion before us. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Whitman. Now we have Representative Hillstrom and House File 1908, non-vehicular evasive flight from peace officer prohibited and penalties provided. Representative Hillstrom, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1908 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
All right, that motion is received. The bill is before us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1908 was brought to me by my local police officer association from the City of Brooklyn Center. Recently, the Supreme Court has ruled that obstruction of justice does not necessarily apply when someone is fleeing a police officer or lying to a police officer in an attempt to allow someone else to flee. And so before you, you have a bill that just states that if you flee a police officer by any other means other than by a motor vehicle, if you attempt to hide or attempt to assist someone else, that you could be guilty of a misdemeanor. Again, the Supreme Court has now ruled that there needs to be, let's see, it says, due to the constitutional considerations discussed in the State versus Krowski, the Minnesota Supreme Court has ruled that for our obstruction law to be constitutional, the obstruction of the officer must be of physical force or by means of such as fighting words which are likely to provoke an immediate breach of peace. That is a problem. And with me, I have Court Holton today that will stand for questions. The Police Officers Association actually had their training today, and so they were unable to make it. But so if there are further questions, they're happy to answer them.
Very good.
I think it stands for itself.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on House File 1908? Raise your hand. I see nobody. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Whitman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, would you have a case citation to State versus Krotowski, or at least a spelling, so if we were interested in reading up?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Whitman, I actually have an entire packet of all of the case law that support this, so I'd be happy to give you a copy.
Thanks.
Any further questions, or we're going to take up the bill at this time? Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1908 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you. Before anyone leaves, Representative Eastland, as a public service announcement?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's an opportunity to visit Lionel Lakes this Wednesday night. The IFI program, the Interchange Freedom Initiative, which is the faith-based program that is operating in the Lionel Lakes prison, is going to have an opportunity for us to go and meet some of those people and learn a little bit more about that program. And I'd encourage any of you that are interested to come to think about coming. I had a handout. I started it that way. I didn't get it going this way. But if you'd like to go, and I'd really encourage you to go and just kind of see how this program works, you need to contact Judy, I think, by today with license numbers, because they need to have clearance to get in. And there's a fairly good list of people that are going, but I encourage people on this committee in particular to go. It's something that really has to do with corrections, and I think gives us some insight. And I think one of the things of interest, there will be some inmates there that are meth on meth charges. And it might be interesting because we'll get a chance to visit with those people about how the impact of this program and the prison system is in their problem. So I'd just encourage you to think about going if you could go and contact Judy if you can.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, to that point, or?
Representative Whitman.
A similar point. I've been invited by Sergeant Lasawi of Oak Park Heights, who's an active union shop steward and also a guard at the Level 6 facility, who's offered to give a tour to members, a guards tour, as opposed to a executives or senior level folks in corrections who usually host the tours. If you're interested in a guards tour of a Level 6 facility, I'm trying to work on that. I think that would be an interesting point of view, and I'll certainly tell members about that, but hopefully in the next couple of weeks we can see it from the line officer's point of view.
All right, now I'll make also an announcement. We have a committee meeting that night starting at 5 o'clock, and we'll just apparently have a competition, but we'll see if we can establish a form that evening. Unless there's any further business to come before this committee, the committee stands adjourned. Thank you for coming on such a day. In the event we have to worry about snow in the future, we'll try to establish. I think we had, before we adjourn a committee, I'm not sure, but I think late last night we started really looking at the weather reports and determined and saw that it could have been rough today. I think we had a method by which we could call in to some number like at 6 in the morning to see if we really were coming in on like a Friday or a Saturday. We'll take a look at the policy of potential weather-related issues. So if anyone got too stressed out, just do what I did and leave at 5 a.m. to get here. Have a nice weekend.
I wouldn't have been so hard.